Ezekiel chapter 9, further details of the vision outlined, page 106. In chapter 8, Ezekiel was given a vision of the terrible apostasy of the nation of Israel. The ninth chapter deals with the execution of the sentence pronounced over them in chapter 8. And the events of the vision in chapter 9 may be set out thus. The glory of Yahweh that resided between the cherubim and the most holy place now stands on the threshold of the sanctuary. And this is the significance of verse 3. The glory of the God of Israel was gone up from the cherub whereupon he was to the threshold of the house. And he calls with a loud voice for them that have charge over the city to draw near. Them that have charge, the RSV renders, executioners. In response to this call, six men appear from the direction of the gate that faces north, each having a weapon of slaughter in his hand. Among the six men, there is another man who is described as being clothed in linen and having a writer's inkhorn by his side. These seven stand beside the brazen altar. The man in linen is commanded to go through the midst of the city and put a mark on the foreheads of the faithful, the men that sigh and that cry for all the abominations that be done in the midst of Jerusalem. The other six men are commanded to follow him and to smite old and young, maids, little children, and women. They are commanded not to touch those who have been marked in their foreheads by the man clothed in linen. They are to begin this work of slaughter in the sanctuary itself, to defile the house and fill the courts with slain. They begin their work immediately by slaying the 25 men between the porch and the altar. They then proceed into the city itself and likewise conduct a work of slaughter. On seeing this, Ezekiel falls on his face and beseeches Yahweh to remember the remnant. And the work of judgment having been accomplished, the man clothed in linen returns and says, I have done as thou hast commanded me. The one who in verse 1 cries in the ears of the prophet is the same one who throughout the 8th chapter had directed Ezekiel's attention to the various aspects of the apostasy of Israel. He had left the most holy place and was in the temple court to greet Ezekiel on his arrival. Whether he directed Ezekiel on his tour of the abominations without leaving the threshold of the temple is not clear, but according to verse 3, that is where the glory is as the events of chapter 9 begin. He it is who cries, calls them that have charge over the city to draw near, or, in the words of the RSV, draw near, you executioners of the city. In answer to this cry, seven men appear, including one carrying a writer's inkhorn by his side. Many commentators suggest that there are seven angels. But this is doubtful, When we are told in verse 2 that six men came, the Hebrew word there translated man is Enosh. There are four principal words used in the Hebrew scriptures that are translated man in the Authorized Version, but which represent four different aspects of man. Adam, which means earthy and has a reference to the origin of man. Geber, which denotes a mighty man or a warrior. Ish, which refers to man as an individual. It denotes any individual male, often in the context of what man does. Man of the field. Man of God. It is interesting to note that when God is spoken of as a man, in Exodus 15, the Lord is a man of war, it is this word Ish that is used. Again, this is the word employed in Joshua 5, where the angelic visitor to Jericho is spoken of as a man, that is Ish, over against him with his sword drawn in his hand. And the fourth word is Enosh, which is the word used in verse 2. There were six Anoshim. The basic meaning of Enosh is that of mankind, and is derived from Enash, which means to be sick, wretched, or weak. It conveys the idea of man's utter inability in physical strength and moral excellence. It is not the kind of word that could be applied to angels. These six Anoshim came from the north. And it seems that we have here another representation of that nation which God was about to employ as the executioner of the city of Jerusalem. For Jeremiah had predicted in the 25th chapter, "Behold, I will send and take all the families of the north and will bring them against this land and against the inhabitants thereof and against all these nations round about and will utterly destroy them and make them an astonishment and an hissing and perpetual desolations." And there is here a very interesting connection with Ezekiel chapter 1, which we can best demonstrate by setting the two passages out in parallel columns. In chapter 1, we have from the north, and in chapter 9, we have from the north. In chapter 1, we have whirlwind, cloud, and fire, all of them symbols of the judgment of God to be meted out. In chapter 9, we have six men, Anoshim, who are said to be the executioners of the city. And that compares with Daniel 3, where the image set up by Nebuchadnezzar as representative of himself, the Babylonian monarch, measured 6 cubits wide by 60 cubits high. And perhaps more relevant, Jeremiah 39, where there are six princes of the king of Babylon named. In chapter 1, we have out of the midst of the whirlwind, cloud, and fire, comes the cherubic chariot bearing aloft the glory of God, that is the one with the face as of the sun and legs like pillars of fire. In the midst of them, chapter 9, that's the revised version, was the man clothed with linen and the writer's inkhorn by his side. The man clothed in linen. The Hebrew word here for man is not the word Enosh, used of the six men, but is the word Ish. If the above comparison is correct, then it would appear that this man clothed in linen corresponds to the man on the throne in chapter 1, who had the appearance of gleaming bronze from his loins up and fire from his loins down. Further evidence that this is so is seen by comparing the visions of Daniel 12 and Revelation 10, which had to do with a man clothed in linen and a mighty one with his face like the sun. So in Daniel 12, we have, I heard the man clothed in linen. Revelation 10, I saw another mighty angel come down from heaven, clothed with a cloud, and a rainbow was upon his head, and his face was, as it were, the sun, and his feet as pillars of fire. Daniel 12, which was upon the waters of the river. Revelation 10, and the angel which I saw stand upon the sea and upon the earth. Daniel, when he held up his right hand and his left hand, Revelation lifted up his hand to heaven. Daniel 12, and swear by him that liveth forever, Revelation, and swear by him that liveth forever and ever. Daniel, that it shall be for a time, times, and an half. But in Revelation, that there should be time no longer. But it may be asked, why is it that here in Ezekiel 9, the one in the midst of the Babylonian army is represented by a man clothed in linen? Whereas in chapter 1, the angelic supervisor of the judgments of God to be poured out upon the nation of Israel by Babylon is represented by a man with legs as pillars of fire. Firstly, we suggest it is because the one with his face as the sun and legs as pillars of fire has already been used in this vision to represent the cherubim in the most holy place and now stands at the threshold of the sanctuary. Secondly, the one in the midst here is performing a different function, or rather a different aspect of his work is being presented. In chapter 1, he was engaged in pouring out judgment, coming with the Babylonian armies to tread upon the high places of Judah. But this man who supervises the work of the six Anishim is clothed with linen, which suggests that he's engaged upon a priestly activity. He reminds us of the high priest who was clothed with linen on the Day of Atonement. The next thing to notice is that this angel, together with the executioners, takes up a position alongside the brazen altar near to which the 25 men stood. The brazen altar, of course, was the altar of sacrifice, and it would appear that in standing alongside this altar, the six Anishim with this priestly man are in fact associating themselves with the altar. A sacrifice is about to be offered. The Babylonian armies represented by the six Anishim constitute the altar. Priestly minister is to be the angelic supervisor of the operation, represented here in the vision by the man clothed in linen. The sacrifice is to be offered is Israel. It shall come to pass, this is Zephaniah chapter 1, in the day of the Lord's sacrifice, that I will punish the princes and the king's sons and all such as are clothed with foreign apparel. And significantly, the prophet continues, and in that day I will punish all those that leap over the threshold which fill their master's house with violence and deceit. This sacrifice is to be accomplished by the lion power of Babylon. And it is interesting to note that the altar is styled the Lion of God in Ezekiel 43. That is the word Ariel. Apart from the partial restoration under Zerubbabel, the consuming fire of God's anger has been burning up the children of Israel for over 2,000 years. But Ezekiel 39 tells us that there is to be a reversal, and the Gentiles are to be a sacrifice upon the mountains of Israel. The one who is to accomplish it will not this time be the Babylonian lion, but the Lion of the tribe of Judah. This lion is the one of whom it is written, "We have an altar, whereof they have no right to eat, which serve the tabernacle." Before the sacrifice is offered, the man clothed in linen with the writer's inkhorn is told to go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, and set a mark upon the foreheads of the men that sigh and that cry for all the abominations that be done in the midst thereof. All those who are faithful in their opposition to the apostasy are to be marked in their forehead. And when the six men are told to begin the work of slaughter, those with the mark in the forehead are to be saved. The mark was placed upon the forehead as a token of something that existed in the mind. In a later time of apostasy, we read, "They that feared the Lord spake often one to another, and the Lord hearkened and heard it. And a book of remembrance was written before him for them that feared the Lord and that thought upon his name. They held the things of the truth in high regard." Similarly, in the book of Revelation, of those who were sealed by the sealing angel, it is said they were sealed in their foreheads. That is, the 144,000 were sealed because, in the words of chapter 14, they had the Father's name written in their foreheads. And in the book of Psalms we read, "If we have forgotten the name of our God or stretched out our hands to a strange God, shall not God search this out? For he knoweth the secrets of the heart." The majority of Israel in Ezekiel's day had indeed forgotten the name of their God, were not interested in his righteousness, and ignored his law. However, God would search it out. The word translated mark is the Hebrew tor, T-A-W, which is the name of the last letter in the Hebrew alphabet. In older Hebrew script, this was written in the form of a cross and may mean no more than mark with a cross. However, some Jewish writers maintain that it is used here to denote the law. Since the word law in Hebrew is Torah, which begins with the letter Tor, it was a symbol to mark those who lived faithfully according to the law. And thus, the mark indicated those of whom the prophet spoke, "Hearken unto me, ye that know righteousness, the people whose heart is my law," or Torah. It's Isaiah 51. Couple of footnotes here. L.C. Allen in Ezekiel, Volume 1, says that the so-called early church fathers seized on this scripture to justify the custom of making the sign of the cross. And Daniel J. Block, in his book of Ezekiel, is the one who says that it was a symbol to mark those who lived faithfully according to the law. The man in linen, having gone forth into the city, the six men are commanded to go after him and pour out the judgments written and to begin at my sanctuary. Here again is further confirmation that the six men represent the Babylonian armies, for it is recorded he brought upon them the king of the Chaldees, who slew their young men with the sword in the house of their sanctuary. That's 2 Chronicles 36. The judgments were to begin in the temple of God. The priest's lips should keep knowledge, and they should seek the law at his mouth, for he is the messenger of the Lord of hosts. But in Ezekiel's day, the priests had failed. They were utterly apostate, and the temple that they had defiled by their abominations was now to be defiled by their own dead bodies. And there's a footnote here. Is the apostle referring to this section of Ezekiel when he writes, "Know ye not that ye are the temple of the living God, and that the Spirit of God dwelleth in you? If any man defile the temple of God, him shall God destroy. For the temple of God is holy, which temple ye are." At the conclusion of the slaughter, Ezekiel the priest alone remained in the temple. However, the shortcomings on the part of the priests did not mean that the ordinary people could be excused. They could not put all the blame on the priests, for God had sent his prophets, and they had rejected them, and so the people too were to be judged. The people who said, "The Lord seeth not," verse 9, were to be shown that he ruleth by his power forever. His eyes behold the nations, Psalm 66. And that the time had arrived when mine eye shall not spare, neither will I have pity. When Solomon dedicated the temple, he prayed that if the people sinned, then hear thou in heaven and do and judge thy servants, condemning the wicked to bring his way upon his head. Only the long-suffering of God had prevented the judgments falling at a much earlier time in their history, but God's long-suffering towards them was now exhausted. And so, I will recompense their way upon their head. Solomon proceeded in his prayer to ask that God would hear and justify the righteous, to give him according to his righteousness. So those who were true children of Abraham, who were marked in their foreheads by reason of the faith that existed there, were to be delivered. The avenging sword of judgment fell on none who were marked. If any such died in the siege, then for them it was but an end of present troubles and a sleep to await the fulfillment of the covenant promise. Yet, there was for many a present physical deliverance, as is seen from the example of Jeremiah, who was one of the faithful in Israel at this time. Yahweh promised Jeremiah, "Verily, I will cause the enemy to entreat thee," that is, entreat thee well, "in the time of evil and in the time of affliction." This was indeed fulfilled in the experience of the prophet. Likewise, before the judgment which was poured out upon Israel in AD 70, Jesus gave his disciples the Olivet prophecy, and those who held the word of God in high esteem fled to the mountains and were saved when the siege of Jerusalem by the Roman army was temporarily withdrawn. When the work of judgment is completed, the man clothed in linen declares, "I have done as thou hast commanded me." In his first letter, Peter writes with a clear allusion to Ezekiel 9, "The time is come that judgment must begin at the house of God, and if it first begin at us, what shall be the end of them that obey not the gospel of God?" In this immediate context, the apostle appears to be referring to the impending Roman judgment that was to overtake the people of Israel, whose end as a nation constituted under the Mosaic law was fast approaching. Judgment which involved the ecclesia. In fact, these judgments began with the Nero persecution, which very much involved the household of God. But it seems likely that in Ezekiel and in Peter there is established a principle of divine judgment that will be evident in judgment yet to come. Firstly, the judgment of the ecclesia when Christ comes as a thief. Then the final judgment of Israel as a result of the Gogian invasion. And then the judgment of the nations, beginning with the overthrow of the Gogian Confederacy. When this is finished, the one clothed in linen, the great high priest himself, will declare, "I have done as thou hast commanded me." There is a sense in which the work is already finished. For the death and resurrection of the Lord guarantees the outcome. And these events yet to come are the result of work already done. "I have finished the work which thou gavest me to do."